Good afternoon. This is the Paleo Protestant Podcast with the Hillsdale History Guys, Miles Smith, Corey Moss, and myself. All doctors, of course, but we're not going to dispense with those titles. as we head into spring break here at the college, although who knows when this will be posted. Could be after the break. But we're going to talk about a comment that Miles Smith made a few recordings ago about drag queen story hour and whether there is a good way to oppose or object to it. And this, for listeners who may not be up to speed, this is goes back to a debate between Sara Bomari, who writes many places, American Conservative Now, First Things, a convert to Roman Catholicism. I don't know if he's really considering himself an integralist, but he's somewhere in that vicinity, and he hangs around with integralist people who would like to see greater harmony between church and state. And that can be as squishy as you want it to be, depending on who you are. And then on the other side is David French, who tweeted what started the whole thing off, tweeted in defense of a drag queen story hour, but along very libertarian legal grounds. Amari wrote a piece against Frenchism, something like that. I'll try to link this in the so-called show notes. And then it took off from there. They had a public debate recorded, and I think it's still available, some YouTube channel. And it seems like both sides, in a way, kind of got caught in a legal sort of framework that French is working from with a, I need to say, with a high gloss of piety mixed in. He can be fairly sanctimonious, I think, about his legal and libertarian formulas. And then, where was I going with that stupid comment? but Amari's on the other side, and he wrote in First Things, and it went from there. So do confessional Protestants have any stake in this? In a certain way, if you were a confessional Protestant living in San Francisco, where there is a drag queen story hour regularly, I think that was one of the features in this exchange. Way back when, I could imagine parents who use the public library not participating in that, but there are probably lots of programs at the San Francisco Public Library that Christian parents don't participate in. So that's a little bit of an outline of where this thing is. But I guess it also goes, this is sort of provoked more generally a question of the degree to which confessional Protestants in our different tribes are on board with liberalism of a kind of 18th century classical liberalism variety, or does classical liberalism eventually lead to drag queen story hour, which is sort of the argument that the integralists make? Or on the other side, if you uphold the 18th century constitutional provisions in the Anglo-American tradition, does that commit you to defending drag queen story hour, even if you are a confessional Protestant? So I'll stop there for now and see which one of you wants to make the first intervention.
I'll go first. I think that one of the interesting things is we tend to assume that there's this kind of assumption that the Constitution is the only law of the land, and therefore that whatever's kind of pegged to a Constitution is the only thing that could have been said about something like decency laws or laws dealing with sexuality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, in the United States, there's actually 50 sets of laws that do that. And at the time the Constitution was written, there was 13 sets of laws. And then very quickly 14 with Vermont and so forth. So I think that it's important to remember that there was all sorts of decency laws that are sort of written by states and by different communities that are entirely consistent with the Constitution's liberal conceptions on disestablishment. You can, a community has the ability to make those decisions. I think that it's probably intellectually dishonest to assume that because someone says the Constitution says blank, that there's no way to be consistent with regulating something like sexual material being given to minors, something like that. There's this law that's going on in Florida right now that, you know, it's been air quoted as the No Say Gay law, but it's really about at what point do you provide materials dealing with sex to elementary age kids. I don't think there's anything about Protestant conceptions of liberal order and disestablished Protestant conceptions of liberal order that keep a state from saying, no, we're not going to provide X to kids. And so I'm increasingly curious why there is a debate over this. And so that's my kind of take on it. I think there's other laws that are perfectly consistent that allow us to make these decisions, and consistent with confessional Protestantism.
Yeah, I'll jump off of that. I mean, I think, Daryl, you hinted at this. I mean, most of us, well, certainly the three of us, I mean, we live in the middle of nowhere, Michigan. Drag queen story hour is not an issue. I had never heard of it until the French Amari debate. And probably even in the context of that debate, nobody would have heard of it if David French had not imprudently said the drag queen story hour is one of the quote unquote blessings of liberty.
100%. Yes.
And that just allowed Amari and everyone else to say, well, there you go. That there's your, it's not even a slippery slope. It's just a logical deduction. If drag queen story hour is one of the blessings of liberty, then liberty is a bad thing. So if French had not said that or written that, I mean, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Nobody would be having this conversation.
I want you to finish your point, but if he had said it a different way, if he had said it's one of the obstacles or challenges of liberty,
yeah,
then so would that be satisfactory? Perhaps.
Or one of the, you know, inevitable problems given a fact of liberty. So I mean, I think one could say, I would want to say that liberty is a blessing. But it's one of those blessings that can be abused. Just to sort of bring this inching towards confessional Protestant responses, one of the things that we teach here in the Hillsdale College core curriculum in our our American Heritage class is John Winthrop's speech to the General Court, where he makes this sort of bog-standard, mind-numbingly, boringly traditional distinction between liberty and license, and makes the point that, you know, true liberty is the liberty to do, you know, the good, that towards which we're oriented. And it's a false and unhelpful conception of liberty to conceive of it as, you know, just doing whatever you want. I don't know if anybody wants to claim Winthrop as a, you know, confessional Protestant in the way we're usually using that term, but that was an entirely bog standard Protestant and Western and even liberal understanding until just about yesterday. And somewhere along the line, we forgot the distinction or became incapable of policing the distinction. Even though, as Miles is pointing out, we do it all the time. So, I mean, but one of the things that Amari was able to do is to sort of take French and to take that particularly imprudent statement and generalize it as representative of what he called conservative liberalism. And he said that conservative liberals object to and are opposed to the use of public power to advance the common good, including in the realm of public morality. Now, that's just about as dumb as what David French said, because not only conservative liberals or liberal conservatives, but liberal liberals and conservative conservatives are all interested in policing public morality. Everybody's doing it. The question is simply on what grounds and in what directions are we going to do it? And I mean, as Miles was alluding to, I don't think conservatives, I don't think liberals, I don't think confessional Protestants are in fact opposed to the use of public power to advance the common good. Because that's just what the state does. That's just what the church does. It's just what the family does. The question is, who gets to define the common good? What kind of power do they get to use to legislate or enforce it?
So, sure. Aside from the question of power, and in particular the power of a library director, which is how I immediately thought of this, but back to Winthrop, who comes closest to my tribe of confessional Presbyterians, when I teach that text, I think, and Corey, I'll be curious if you what you make of this, because you teach about, you did a whole course on religious liberty, I believe.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
You're working on a book. But when I read Winthrop, I hear the Roman Catholic position of error has no rights. That in fact, he's saying that true liberty is liberty to do good. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not perhaps as explicit at times as the Roman Catholic Church has been, but that if you do wrong, you are a slave to evil. So true liberty is doing good, and slavery is doing bad, to make it very simple. And I mean, and that actually comes up again in a way. I see it in the American Heritage Reader when we come to the Kentucky resolutions and the counter response from Massachusetts. Actually, they are one of the longest excerpts we have there, and they talk about freedom of speech not being used a certain way.
Right, right.
And I hear echoes of Winthrop there, but also a broader Western Christian conception. This isn't Protestant, it's Protestant and Roman Catholic, minus Anabaptists, that you got to use liberty well or else you can't have it.
Yeah.
In effect. And I mean, that's perfectly sensible. I mean, I don't have children, but I could imagine a parent saying to a child, you have liberty to use the car as long as you don't wreck it. Okay. I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which that makes perfect sense. But that it does become an issue, though, of how much we let stuff that we don't like go. And do we defend it in some way? Maybe not the way French has done it. And you know, part of his argument was that we defend this liberty for drag queen story hour because if we don't, then churches won't have access to public buildings in New York City, for instance, which is some of the work I guess he's done.
Yep. And, no, that's right.
You know, and it could be that somebody would say, well, no, I'm not going to defend. And if we have to suffer having excess, we'll figure something out. But yeah, it seems like he ties himself into a certain position that you, and again, the blessings word is a pretty significant one.
Yeah. And I think you're right that he is, and again, this is one of the things that Amari and others accuse him of, being tied to a kind of proceduralism. Mm-hmm. So we have to let them do this so that they will let us do this. And French has been accused of simply being, well, A, you know, enslaved to proceduralism, but B, naively so, because even if we do let them do this, they're not going to let us do what we want to do. So they think that he's just kind of unrealistic. But to go back to, I think you're absolutely right that in Winthrop, and even in that Massachusetts counter-resolution that you mentioned about free speech, that there is a whiff of error has no rights, and that phrase is most commonly associated with sort of 19th century reactionary Catholicism. But I mean, one of the ways that later Catholics wanted to temper what might have been overly an overreactionary formula was to say, well, that's true. You know, you don't have a right in the sense of a sort of God-given inalienable right to do something that is morally wrong or to say something that is actually untrue. But that doesn't mean that we don't and can't tolerate error. So you might not have a right to do X, Y, or Z, but if you do, it might be prudent for any number of reasons to tolerate that. So an example, you know, the same body with vocal members who could have said in the 19th century that error has no rights, you know, is the body that controlled medieval cities that proactively legalized prostitution. On sort of Augustinian grounds that, sure, prostitution is a bad thing, but if we don't allow it, even worse things are going to happen. So I don't think that they would have, you know, been at all amused by someone saying, you know, I have a right to sell sex. They would say, no, well, of course you don't, but we're going to tolerate that because we think tolerating it is more conducive to the common good than the kinds of measures it would take to repress it and some of the potential consequences of repressing it. So I guess this is, and we can come back to some more potentially specific confessional Protestant ways to address this. But I would say maybe the mistake in all of this is turning it into a matter of principle, which I think both French and Amari did, rather than a matter of prudence.
Yeah, I think that when I think about what confessional Protestants can speak to, what they can actually speak to, because I think there's an appropriate caution within within confessional Protestant communions about just saying, well, this is obviously, there's an appropriate caution about just an immediate kind of biblicist judgment about something like this. But I've thought about if you substitute, because Drag Queen Story Hour is I think it gets people's attentions because it is sensational, right? Like the image of someone who is pushing sexuality on kids, it just, right, boom, it's there. I wondered if you were to change the conversation, say, okay, is there a confessional Protestant way of opposing no-fault divorce? Right, this is another, like, you know, mid to late 20th century kind of innovation. It seems easier to talk about because, well, obviously most of the Protestant communions have canons dealing with how churches, you know, deal with divorce. And so I'm wondering if the conversation seems sensational because of just the sort of the image of Drag Queen Story Hour when we've really been having this conversation for a long time, and it's over things like divorce. It's over things that are just a lot seemingly more mundane, but we've sort of, I think Protestant communions have had these conversations really through, and I think this is what you're saying, Corey, really through a question of, okay, how is it prudent for us? Like, a church may not actually think that this should be a law, but how do we interact with it now that it's passed? I mean, we don't have a Constantinian system. The church doesn't inform laws necessarily. So how do you deal with it once it passes? So I wonder if it's really a question of what do we do as members of bodies who are downstream from lawmaking in a way that our predecessors weren't. I wonder if that's actually the initial question, whether it's even a question of confessionalism or not. I don't know the answer, but I've thought about that.
No, yeah, I mean, I think that's right. Although going back to your point that, you know, federal law is not the only law.
Right.
And in this conversation, it's not even the relevant law for talking about what local public libraries do. We could say, sure, we're downstream of policymaking and lawmaking at the federal level, but maybe not at the local level.
Yeah.
You know, I don't belong to a particularly big congregation. But I have my suspicions that if even half of the members of my congregation showed up at a library board meeting and said, hey, you know what, let's not do this Drag Queen Story Hour, I probably the library board would listen.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe I'm the one being naive now. But
no, I was on the library board here. So I would say, since we never had or rarely had any guests whatsoever, we would listen.
And back to your point, Daryl, I mean, Drag Queen Story Hour as a phenomenon and as an organization. So it is actually an organization that now has chapters across the country. I mean, it did start in San Francisco. And I don't think anyone is surprised by that. And so if a majority of San Franciscans are happy to see that in their local library, which I suspect a majority of San Franciscans are, what are the options? So there, you know, a confessional Protestant who lives in or around San Francisco, that doesn't really have any capital to change that. But I get the sense that some of the people that are really pushing back on this, that their answer is, well, that's right. And that's why this has to be kicked up to a federal level, where, you know, some agency under the aegis of my president can put a stop to this. There are sort of much bigger questions behind the simple question of what happens at a particular local library that are part of this conversation.
Yeah, and I guess... go ahead, Daryl.
Well, I mean, what about, aside from the law and being litigious, which, you know, when you're... It's an easy... Well, it's a natural way to go, I guess, in some respects. Because you're dealing with a public agency, and it's probably a pretty big, well, relatively big item in a city budget, et cetera. But I still wonder how the director of the library would respond to meetings from parents who came in and simply, you know, got on the schedule and said, we want to express our concerns about this. We would prefer that it didn't happen. But the day that when you're having this, we're bringing our kids regularly to the library on that day. And we'd prefer that our kids not have to deal with this. So we'd prefer not to have to answer questions about this. Is there a way that you could accommodate us in some way? And I mean, I would imagine too, if you went into the professional standards for directors of libraries from the whatever library association there is out there, they probably have some guidelines for public librarians that they need to be responsive to the public in some way. And I don't know if I really think that a majority of San Franciscans would support this. I don't think a majority would object to it, but I think probably you'd have maybe 40% for, 10% opposed, and the other people in the middle maybe thinking it's kind of silly. That it's just sort of in your face, and it doesn't need to be that way, which is how it does come across. You know, and I could in my tribe, I could imagine, and we've had some issues in our San Francisco churches about firing a homosexual organist, and that organist sued. So our churches out there have had some dealings with the courts and lawmakers. But and I could imagine some of our people going in there and saying, well, if you're going to have this, then we want to have a Westminster Confession reading hour. And, you know, I mean, that might be a way of accommodating, too. So you have every single group have a reading hour. But I guess I'm long-winded way of asking, does someone like that in that office actually worry about alienating part of his or her patrons, part of the population of the people who use the library? And, you know, we're living at a time, I think, where a lot of public officials don't really care that much about alienating some people, because they think they have the truth, the good position, and people really should, you know, it's like error has no rights. Talk about that. People who dissent from this view really shouldn't have much. We don't need to listen to them. It's kind of the reverse side of Winthrop. Yeah. In a very, I don't know what you'd call it. So are there just basic human instincts of decency, and that might force Christians to approach a librarian that way, and a librarian might respond to the public in a different way.
I think the simple answer is yes and no. I don't actually know how public library boards are formed. I mean, or how a director is chosen. Is this an appointed position? Is it an elected position? But in any case, I imagine that is a little of both. I mean, some people are sort of politicians in their bones, and so their finger is always in the wind. And yeah, if there's public uproar, they're going to back down. Some people are ideologues, and if there's public uproar, they're not going to back down because what they think they're doing is, they think what they're doing is right. Each situation is probably going to be different.
But they're not elected, you know, so you don't have, I don't think they're elected. I mean, I don't know. It would be surprising to me if any librarian of a major urban system were elected. I think they would be chosen
by city council
or a city council would choose the board members who would be responsible for hiring, and they would go through a hiring process.
Okay.
And curiously enough, I have following Philadelphia news the way I do, way back when in the summer after the George Floyd death and the controversy, African-American staff members and supporters at the Philadelphia Public Library were complaining about the library not being a safe space. And eventually they were able to gain enough momentum to have the librarian there fired by the board. They put enough pressure on the board. And this woman, I'm convinced, would have been opposite of me in so many ways politically. And yet I really felt badly for her because she wasn't doing anything that was that aggressive. You know, it was just people had a certain sense of grievance and being marginalized as that controversy played out, not to mention 4 months into the pandemic, a lot of heightened awareness of various sorts of grievances, but they just capitulated to it, and they let her go. And I don't think she'd done anything wrong. And it's now taken them 2 years to hire someone else. They hired a former police chief, African American man of all things, who has some library experience as well. But
as we're talking here, it strikes me as we're, I think, assuming a certain socio-civilizational framework that people have to interrelate. And like on the question of toleration, like, okay, well, you don't believe what I do about this. I don't believe what you do. Maybe we should just like, let's just not do it. You know, let's have peace. And then Daryl, you're right. I think that there's a sort of new error has no rights that's making its way into, especially, you know, blue cities and blue states. But I think the essential question is, I think there's almost this framework where we're saying, okay, over here is a concern, maybe a reactionary conservative version of error has no rights. And over here is a liberal or progressive version of error has no rights. And ideally there's this neutral middle where error is tolerated. And I think ultimately, like, I'm less convinced I used to be that tolerant middle is actually neutral. Like, I think it's another version of a certain other type of error has no rights. And I think it's the liberal version of error, the historic liberal version of error has no rights. And I think that's not a neutered position. And so I think especially amongst people like me who I believe I was talking with a colleague this the other day, like, I think the liberal order worked. Like, I think 2008 America was a good place to live in. But I don't think that was a neutral America. Like, there was a commitment there to something. And so I think that ultimately this is really less about kind of a search for neutrality. And I don't think that's what you guys are saying. But I think that's what the disposition is. I think that's maybe when you dialogue with someone like a David French, what he's really saying is that, look, that we can all enjoy this space because this is a neutral space, that we don't have to have certain types of moral commitments, when actually that middle space has really firm types of moral commitments. And so I think that's something I've thought more about, is that you have to teach a group of people a lot of things over a lot of generations to get them to think that way. And that middle is kind of, it's losing numbers. It was never neutral. I think what's happening is being peeled off.
When you say really firm moral commitments in that middle.
Yeah. Like I think liberal.
So how firm is it? Or is it, I mean, I just was teaching an essay by William James of all things yesterday, so don't hold me too much to this. But I was struck by the way he was trying to frame moral philosophy and morality and trying to balance against what we would call extremes. He was calling sort of hard, resilient moral imperatives and trying to find some kind of, and again, we would call it lowest common denominator, but he wouldn't use that language, but it seems like that's what he was trying to go. Where he was trying to go was try to find a kind of consensus, a moral consensus among as many people as possible, but they would have to lose in this consensus, they would have to lose some of the aspects of what they have. And so that's why I'm wondering about how really firm this is, because if it's a Venn diagram of what people will agree to, but the stuff that's outside, that's not in it, might be the really firm parts of it. So I might have to give up Sabbatarianism to get this moral consensus. The library may have to be open on Sundays, but it could still be a moral consensus about the library and what it does, even though I give up that. So I'm just pushing you a little bit on what really firm means.
So I think firm means, and I can't immediately think of like the narrative that gets to this firmness, but I mean, think about like the reasons for a long time that, like, just basically, you know, Jews and Catholics and Protestants could go to a restaurant on a Thursday night and all have a meal, right? Like, because you had some sort of, you know, conceptions of the golden rule, or just, I think about that kind of broad Abrahamic civilizational commitments, like those mattered. And so I think there is a firmness, like, you know, if I were to go into, you know, a space and say the golden rule doesn't matter, do unto others that you would have them do to you, that's ridiculous. Like, there would probably be pretty substantive pushback, right? Like, so the golden rule is a fairly firm thing. Like, that's something that's hard. And society, like, operated on that for a long time. And I think society would think it still does. So I think that if you've got a moral consensus that lasted for at least 200 or 300 years in the Anglo-American context, like, that wasn't shaky. I mean, when you've got like the Princetonians and someone like Lord Macaulay arguing for the same type of civilizational commitments, I don't think that it's not vaporous. Like, they're talking about a something, and we can use all sorts of different words to describe it. Liberal conservative. I don't know what the preferred taxonomy from each everybody would be, but that was a something, and it was a substantive something that everybody could look at and be like, that's how this is supposed to work.
I think maybe a bit broader than do unto others, is that there seemed to be a pretty broad consensus on what we might call, you know, natural law, as summarized in something like the Ten Commandments. And it was a cultural consensus. And I think, to sort of bring this back around to the churches, you know, tell me if I'm way off base here, but I think where the churches sort of did themselves and society a disservice was being content in the resilience of that 300 or even 2,000 year moral consensus, such that we didn't feel it quite so necessary to teach or preach morality. You know, we can focus on the distinctives of Christianity, you know, the gospel, or the distinctives of our tradition, and be fairly confident that society is going to inculcate and enforce the kind of morality that is consonant with natural law and with the Ten Commandments. And so we don't have to spend a lot of time on that. And I think that we were right about that for a long time. And then overnight that changed, and a lot of us woke up and realized, holy smokes, we haven't actually been teaching our kids that certain things are wrong, because we were fairly confident that even the public schools would do that. And so we're kind of shocked when we realize, no, the public schools and the public libraries and everybody else is actually teaching exactly contrary to what was the moral consensus, you know, 2 days ago. So I think we're going to be playing catch up for a long time.
Mm. Well, at that break, let me just go to this week's sponsor.
Right on.
The Library of America series, the designated volume this episode is Edgar Allan Poe, Poetry and Tales, edited by Patrick Quinn. Read throughout the world, admired by Dostoevsky, and translated by Baudelaire. I should have probably taken out Dostoevsky given the current political climate, but Edgar Allan Poe has become a legendary figure, representing the artist as obsessed, outcast, and romantic failure. His nightmarish visions, shaped by cool artistic calculation, reveal some of the dark possibilities of human experience. His enormous popularity and his continuing influence of literature depend less on legend or vision than on his stylistic and formal accomplishments as a writer of fiction and a great lyric poet. In this complete and uniquely authoritative Library of America collection, well-known tales of mystery and imagination and his best-known verse are collected with early poems, rarely published, stories and humorous sketches, and the ecstatic prose from Eureka. A special feature of this volume is the care taken to select an authoritative text of each work. The printing and publishing history of every item has been investigated in order to choose a version that incorporates all of Poe's own revisions without reproducing the errors or changes introduced by later editors. Here, then, is one of America's and the world's most disturbing, powerful, and inventive writers, published in the first truly dependable collection of Poe's Poetry and Tales. And for you listeners out there, go to loa.org/books/podcast for a complete description of this volume of Library of America.
Edgar Allan Poe's awesome.
So sorry, Miles, you were about to say something.
Oh no,
I appreciate your patience.
No, that's there's a great bar in Sullivan's Island, South Carolina, called Poe's.
Yeah,
he was stationed there.
There are so many places on the East Coast, houses of Poe. There's one in Philly. There's one in Baltimore. There's one in Richmond. And then he left a trail up and down the East Coast. Anyways, but you were
In New Orleans, you can eat a Poe boy sandwich.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, maybe that's something different though.
I think Corey's point to me seems so essential, because I think there's this question of what can confessional Protestants do? And so, like, how do you sort of keep from having your reflexive first thing be, we need to go take over the government. We need to get an Anglican president or LCMS president or governor. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think, like, just the foundational thing is Corey's point is, like, you should probably catechize your kids. Like, just like the first, like, first basic thing that a church can do is to say, okay, we need to think about the relationship between morality and catechesis, and churches can ask those questions without sort of feeding, I think, the worst dispositions of sort of the new right, which might be some sort of statist, you know, hope for a new American Caesar or something like that. I think if if the foundation is churches, you're able to actually say, okay, this is a confessional Protestant doing confessional Protestant stuff without kind of feeding the beast of integralism or some of the excesses on the new right.
So on this point, though, of doing good unto others, I tend to think, maybe call me naive, that the people reading at the Drag Queen Story Hour and the librarian who signed off on that program actually do believe in doing good unto others. And maybe I'm wrong, but I tend to think that's still a common conception. There's a problem there with doing good unto those who you typically demonize. That's hard. It's hard for me too. I mean, it would be hard for me to do good unto David French, for instance. Kind of a joke, but but I still think that's there. And for some reason, I mean, I can also see that the librarian or the committee responsible for this program has a wants to be a champion of a certain vision, a certain view of America where drag queen people, trans people are going to be more prominent, more publicly accepted or something. And therefore, the people opposed to that are the ones who need to be demonized. But I still think somewhere in there, there's a recognition that you have to do good unto others. And there's just perhaps not enough interaction between these groups. And I don't know how you get that to happen other than through public institutions like a public library, perhaps. Or am I just wrong that other people, wrong in thinking that other people recognize that moral conviction still, whether they can identify it with any particular religion or the Western heritage somehow?
I think you're partly right. I mean, so for example, I mentioned that the Drag Queen Story Hour is not just a phenomenon, but it's actually an organization. And I looked them up this afternoon, and the first thing that you find on their website, on their about statement, is that they are intentionally trying to, quote, capture the imagination of the gender fluidity of childhood and give kids glamorous, positive, and unabashedly queer role models. Hmm. Because of overly rigid gender restrictions. So, I mean, they see themselves as, I'm doing good to these children because they're kind of being brainwashed into this binary male-female gender thing. And if I were being brainwashed into a binary male-female gender thing, I would hope that somebody would kind of promote diversity and tolerance and acceptance and all that stuff. So, I mean, there's a sense in which I'm absolutely sure that they tell themselves, I'm doing unto others what I would want them to do unto me.
But that, at that point, it seems to me the librarian really needs to have a timeout and say, what are you doing?
Right.
I mean, geez, you wouldn't let theonomists into the library to have a theonomy reading because they think people, kids at home, are being brainwashed in some kind of liberal political order. So,
right.
So what can you possibly be thinking? I don't know the demographics of San Francisco that well, but I still don't imagine that the trans community is that large.
No.
Well, and LBG parts of it, I think it's increasingly fragile how much of a community that is, but still.
No, absolutely.
Well, this is where I think this language of, you hear this in the new right. I'm this language of regime, right? Like there's a regime that's pushing this. It doesn't matter how many there are. That it's sort of right. Like it's a regime commitment. And so, like, I'm skeptical of that, that language, but I think that's where people's mind will go. So, like, if you're going to argue against that, you've got to spin out somehow that this was just like that people really want this, because either the people really want it or someone else is pushing it. And so I think in that sense, I think that I keep coming back to, I think we've overassumed neutrality for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Overassumed neutrality. Things were never as neutral as we hoped or wanted them to be. And so I think that, like,
no, and I think
we need to rethink that. Seriously. Sorry.
I mean, yeah. I think your earlier point about you and I may differ about the really firmness of the moral component of the public common space, the common good. But I think thinking about that in terms of a moral commitment, however firm it is useful as far as thinking about it instead of something neutral. So you leave out the morality and you try to find this space that doesn't have it. Well, you know, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, when you start bringing it back in, then there are that, you know, to use the cliche, the thick descriptions of the morality that, okay, now we've got a space. We can bring that thickness back in there. And okay, we don't have, did we used to have good arbiters of how to keep the thick out and to keep the thin moral component in there? Or
I think sometimes I wonder if we did have something thick and it was liberal Protestantism.
Yeah.
And now that the main line's gone, like that thickness is gone. So I think this is one of the reasons why people might sort of say, well, how could it have been that thick? Look how tolerant it was. And well, the answer is the thickness is it brings about a sort of a liberal Protestant style tolerance. So the tolerance was the thickness. And now the main line's gone. And so guess what? That thickness is gone too. So I don't think that the thickness has to be something that adheres to sort of like a violent left wingism or a violent right wingism. I think that the tolerance was the thickness in a lot of ways, but was pinned to liberal Protestantism for a long time.
And this reminds me of another point, and we're running out of time, so we won't have chance to talk about it for that long, I guess. But one of the things that strikes me as frustrating about French's writing is that, and this is common, this is a very common aspect of public discourse since 2016, at least, that you cannot give any concession to the person that's really bad right now. And it's okay to go really hard against that person, maybe even adopting imprecatory psalms right now about the president of Russia. That's okay, because that's how bad that is, even though we wouldn't go near an imprecatory psalm in our right mind in normal times. So there's this, I'm going to take a position that makes sure people don't associate me with that. But it also seems like when you appeal to the mainline, I feel like that's what happened to the mainline in the 60s, that they wanted to make sure they weren't associated with anything that was an obstacle to civil rights for blacks, anything that was supportive of the Vietnam War and the foreign policy establishment behind it, and anything that was going to be restrictive for women, whether in the workplace or in the bedroom. I mean, so that I don't know why they couldn't have thought through the morality of that. They had people who could have done it, but is it the case that the public face of a writer or an institution to maintain you think your best case is to maintain that public reputation, that public standing, and so you can't take the other side? Although, of course, someone like Ross Douthat is a testimony that you can do that, but he's only a writer. David French could take a few cues from him. He's not an institution, but that's what bothers me about the Protestant mainline. I do think that was a kind of moral consensus that related relatively well to Jews and Roman Catholics and even sideline Protestants. And it just caved really quickly.
I got nothing to add.
All right. Well, this is maybe too much politics for us anyway. So I will bring us to a close and dismiss you, give you the old life benediction for spring break. And and listeners, hope you come back at some point, and we will talk sometime soon. All right. Take care.
Thanks, Darryl.
Bye.